Okay, ladies and gentlemen, we're going to have people coming in, but I look around this room and I know I can't afford the billing hours that are sitting here, so we're going to get this thing going here. My name is John Hamry. I'm the president here at CSIS, and normally on a Monday morning, you don't get 250 people show up at CSIS for lectures, and I think that's undoubtedly has something to do with the speaker, Senator. But it probably also has something to do with an election and a completely transforming landscape, policy landscape, in Washington. And people want to know, where the hell are we going? And so, for very good reason, they want to come and listen to one of those guys that stands a little bit higher on the horizon, is able to look out and give all of us a little bit of a look ahead and say, here's what's possibly coming. I'm just very pleased to welcome Senator Jeff Bingaman with us. He was once my boss, and when you work for a senator, you work for him your whole life. And so he is still one of my bosses. He was on the Armed Services Committee when I was a staffer there, and I've had the real pleasure of staying in touch with him through the years. And asked him, I said, "Sir, you're not going to make any changes, are you, with the new Congress?" He says, "No, I'm going to stay with the committees I'm at." And we're all going to breathe a very big sigh of relief for that, because he provides the depth of leadership that we need, obviously, in energy and natural resources, as well as in the Armed Services Committee. So we're very, very grateful that he's going to do that, and we'll stay saddled up to these great big issues, and boy, do we have them. So David Pumphrey is going to actually be leading this session. He'll formally introduce the senator and field the questions from all of you. Thank you all for coming. This is going to be a very good session. And thank you, Senator. Delighted you're here. David, why don't you take over?
Good morning, everybody. I'm David Pumphrey. I'm a senior fellow here with the Energy and National Security Program, and it's certainly an honor to have Senator Bingaman here with us to talk about a topic that has been getting a considerable amount of attention over through the campaigns, as well as now we move into sort of the follow-up and actual governance as we move forward. First, if everyone out of courtesy could turn off their cell phones so we don't have those ringing. We're going to have a fairly large group here, and we don't want to have too many disturbances. I don't think to many of you Senator Bingaman needs much introduction. He is the chairman of the Senate Energy and Natural Resources Committee in his fifth term, senior senator from New Mexico. But in addition to the energy portfolio, Senator Bingaman serves on several committees that I think will be very important as we begin to integrate these issues of energy, national security, and the economy. He is on the Finance Committee and the Subcommittee on International Trade and Global Competitiveness, the Joint Economic Committee, and the Health, Education, and Labor and Pensions Committee. So he has a unique perspective on the issues that we'll be facing. The advertised topic is energy priorities for the next Congress, but of course, I think when we bring together climate change and energy security, we'll be very interested in his views on how we proceed on an energy agreement, on a climate agreement, and climate legislation, and bring all these different issues together. So with no further ado, please welcome Senator Bingaman.
Thank you. David, thank you very much. And John, thank you for your kind words and the invitation to be here. It's an important subject, energy priorities in the new Congress. Let me start by just being acknowledging and being sure you all recognize Bob Simon, who heads our Democratic staff on the Energy Committee. Bob is here somewhere right here. I hope you all are acquainted with Bob. If you're not, you should be. And I think we have a real opportunity in this new Congress, in the 111th Congress, to make serious progress on dealing with energy issues. And I say that for an obvious reason, that President-elect Obama has made this a priority in his campaign. He's indicated a strong commitment to solving our energy problems in a bipartisan way. And I believe that when you get the combination of a newly elected president with a strong commitment in an issue area like we have now, and and congressional bipartisan engagement on that issue as well, I think the chances of making real progress are substantial. In my view, at least, that was much of what explains our success in the now completing Congress, or now ending Congress, with the enactment of the Energy Independence and Security Act of 2007. President Bush started that debate, really national debate, by including in his 2007 State of the Union speech several important policy initiatives in the energy area, calling for more production of alternative transportation fuels, for higher fuel economy standards for automobiles. In our Senate Energy Committee, we developed what we considered a strong energy bill with large majorities on both the Democratic and Republican sides, and that formed the basis for a bill to go to the floor, which became a significant piece of legislation. The Energy Independence and Security Act is projected to make a real difference in the trajectory of our future oil imports as well as our future carbon dioxide emissions. I know Guy Caruso is here somewhere. I just saw him. Where's Guy? Well, you can blame these figures on him while he was at the Energy Information Administration. They projected that we would have a savings of 3 million barrels per day in 2030 as a result of that legislation, barrels of oil, and we would also see carbon dioxide emissions cut by 500 million metric tons per year by 2030 as a result of that legislation. I don't think we can identify any previous energy legislation that has passed in this country that has made that much of a difference. But as important as those reductions are, both in imported oil and in emissions, it needs to be recognized that in comparison to the problems and to the challenges that we face, the reductions that we have made are relatively modest. They are only a small down payment on what needs to be done if we are to fully secure our energy future and effectively prevent dangerous global warming. So this morning what I'd like to do is to talk about some of the principal energy challenges, policy challenges I think we face in this new Congress. And I would put those in six categories, if you're keeping track. First is the challenge of deploying clean energy technology. Second, the challenge of improving energy efficiency. Third, maintaining adequate supplies of conventional fuels. Fourth, increasing energy innovation. Fifth, making energy markets more transparent. And sixth, maintaining the proper balance between energy and our environmental policies, particularly as it relates to global warming. So these are the challenges that I expect us to be working on in the Energy Committee. In the new Congress, I'm going to be doing what I can in coordination with the new administration and with both the Democrats and Republicans on the committee to make progress on these issues. So let me go through each of these briefly. The first major set of challenges we face in the deployment of new energy technology is in the electricity sector, as I see it. For many years, I've been advocating a national renewable electricity standard for generation, a renewable portfolio standard, or electricity standard. In my view, we need a strong long-term market pull for the generation technologies that utilize clean energy sources such as wind power and solar power and biomass and enhanced geothermal systems. And in the coming Congress, I think we finally have the opportunity to see such a policy adopted and implemented. The National Renewable Electricity Standard will enhance the diversity of our domestic electricity generation, and it will position the United States to regain the world technology lead in these areas and start preparing our electricity sector for the inevitable requirements to reduce greenhouse gas emissions that will be part of our policy challenge as well. Next year, I hope we can work in a bipartisan way to formulate the strongest possible renewable electricity standard that we can pass through the Congress. Other ways of stimulating renewable electricity generation, such as use of the tax code, can help, and they have helped to some extent, but by themselves they cannot do the job that we need to do. The tax incentives in particular have been too intermittent, too short-lived to have the consistent signal that electricity resource planners and investors need. The shortcomings of a tax-only strategy are being highlighted by the current recession and credit crunch. Simply put, tax credits have less value when there are no profits against which to claim the credit. So in addition to more renewable generation, we need to implement a smart and robust national transmission grid. I think there is general bipartisan sentiment growing around the country in favor of addressing some of the tough issues that have kept us from developing a strong national electrical grid. These issues include the issue of transmission planning, transmission siting, and also the issue of cost allocation. All of these are very difficult issues, and doing something on any of them will require intensive dialogue among a large set of stakeholders. In addition to these issues, we need to adequately fund the smart grid programs that Congress put in place in the 2007 Act. Not only would quick implementation of these smart grid programs strengthen one of our critical national infrastructures, doing so would also quickly create some new jobs. And for these reasons, I hope that significant smart grid funding can be included in a stimulus bill when one finally does get enacted here. Another key clean energy technology for the future, of course, is carbon capture, transportation, and storage. In the next Congress, we need to enact a comprehensive approach to this technology that addresses the need to rapidly deploy commercial-scale projects. There are important regulatory questions that we need to address, as well as funding issues for large projects of this type. The final major issue with respect to clean energy technology deployment I want to mention this morning relates to the financing of large-scale deployment of new technologies. For several years, we've been looking for ways to facilitate the large-scale investments that are needed in the energy sector. This problem has become even more acute as a result of the meltdown of our financial markets. In 2005, we created a loan guarantee program at the Department of Energy to help commercialize innovative energy technologies. To date, the program has yet to issue a loan guarantee. Although the slow start that has occurred is in part due to conflicts among the Congressional Appropriations Committees. I think we need to take a hard look in the new Congress at whether this program is structured correctly, whether the loan guarantee mission could be more effectively exercised by an entity outside of the Department of Energy. We also need to look at ways in which we can supplement the existing loan guarantee authority with other mechanisms to help finance large new clean energy projects. Let me turn to the issue, second issue of improving energy efficiency. I'll begin with energy efficiency and transportation. One of the most important things we did in the 2007 Act was to increase CAFE standards for the first time in over 30 years. We set up a direct loan program to retool Detroit, and this past September, just a couple of months ago, Congress gave that program enough money to make $25 billion in loans. We're all aware that there are major pressures to restructure the auto industry, and as we work through that set of issues, we need to look at what more can be done to create incentives for promoting energy efficiency in transportation. With gas prices falling, we need other economic incentives to encourage consumers to continue to buy the most fuel-efficient vehicles. And our vehicle tax incentives, in my view, need to be overhauled and brought up to date. Right now, I would argue that we have enacted very technology-specific incentives, and we should try to get away from that to the extent possible. In energy efficiency after transportation, the next largest source of potential energy efficiency improvements is in the building sector. Our current federal laws to promote building efficiency are very weak. We need to do more to promote the adoption of modern energy-saving building codes across the country. We also need to do a better job of giving building owners and prospective buyers more information on the energy performance rating of their buildings. The Department of Energy has engaged a lot of builders in this country constructively through a Build America program, and we need to look for ways to strengthen this program. In the energy efficiency area, another subject we need to deal with is appliance efficiency standards. We need to look at ways to enhance existing appliance standards, and we need to consider whether an alternative regulatory approach would make sense here, something like what Japan has labeled its Top Runner program. See if such a thing would make sense in this country. Finally, in the area of energy efficiency, we need to redouble our efforts to reduce the industrial sector's energy intensity by 2015. Without such a program, volatile energy prices will continue to damage our manufacturing base and threaten higher wage American jobs. The third of these six issues I wanted to discuss briefly relates to maintaining adequate supplies of conventional fuels. Obviously, our push for new clean sources of energy and greater energy efficiency does not mean that we can ignore our existing major sources of energy. We need to make the transition to an energy future where our reliance on traditional fossil fuels will be lessened, but in that transition, as that transition occurs, we need to recognize that it will take time. Our energy strategy has to make sure we have adequate supplies of conventional fuels as we go through this. We need an intelligent policy to continue to promote domestic production of oil and gas, both onshore and offshore. That production has to be undertaken in an environmentally responsible way, with recognition that multiple users and stakeholders are involved. The reason we wound up with the Congressional Outer Continental Shelf moratorium in the first place back in the 80s was in reaction to the ill-conceived large leasing effort by former Secretary James Watt. I hope we are smarter and more strategic this time in how we go about developing offshore oil and gas resources. Perhaps a good next step would be to undertake a serious and expeditious inventory of the energy resources on the Outer Continental Shelf. Congress called for such an inventory in the 2005 bill we passed. We never did provide the funds to carry that out, so the result obviously was not meaningful. Major energy development projects require steady strategy and steady investments over a long period, and we also need to base those policies on a stable political consensus that is not reversed every few years. In my view, that means that we should get the best data we can on both the energy and environmental characteristics of potential areas of production. Getting that data on a priority basis will increase the chances that we will make energy supply choices that we can sustain economically and environmentally and politically. The fourth area relates to increasing energy innovation. Our ability to deliver new energy technologies and innovations, obviously depends crucially on our ability to fund new energy science and engineering, and on training the next generation of energy researchers and engineers and technicians. Our investments in these areas have been totally inadequate over the past decade. We need to boost these levels substantially. I believe the enactment of the COMPETES Act with strong bipartisan support in the last Congress now finishing is an indication that that we can do what's needed here. I look forward to working with folks both on and off the Energy Committee to see if we can increase those resources to the levels they should be at. Along with the enhanced resources, we need to take a look at every stage of the innovation process, examine how effective our existing programs are at spurring innovation. The Bush administration did not do much with the ARPA-E concept that we've seen debated and enacted. Apparently, there's not been a great deal of success either with the DARPA model that was put in place at the Department of Homeland Security. Some of you may be more expert in what progress has been made there. But one of our challenges in the next Congress and for the new administration is to see how we can set up an entity that focuses on prototyping transformative energy technologies that fall between the existing institutional cracks in the system. The fifth subject I wanted to talk about is the challenges in energy policy related to the functioning of energy markets. As oil and gas prices gyrated wildly over the last year, most of us became aware of what experts like Dan Yergin have been referring to as the new fundamentals in energy markets. Obviously, we haven't repealed the laws of supply and demand, but there are other forces at work that are also affecting energy prices, particularly in patterns of energy investment and trading. We clearly need better data and better oversight of these new market players and forces if we want energy markets to function effectively in the future. The final subject I wanted to talk about a little bit relates to maintaining the proper balance between energy and environment, and particularly as that relates to global warming. We face an international climate crisis that demands a worldwide revolution in energy technology if we are to prevent catastrophic environmental changes. We need to push forward with that energy revolution. The scale of our energy system, both here in the United States and globally, is so large that if we want to see real changes anytime soon, then we do not have the luxury of partisan delay. When a cap-and-trade bill came to the Senate floor earlier this year, much of the debate was on the generalities of dealing with climate change. It was not on the specific merits of any particular part of that bill. We now need to have a robust debate over how best to construct a mandatory regulatory regime to mitigate global climate change. Building a broad consensus on what that regulatory regime should look like is not going to be easy. No one that I've spoken to expects quick action on a cap-and-trade bill when the new Congress convenes in January. Frankly, for as much time as many of us in Congress have spent on the issue, we're still uncovering new complexities in the issue in terms of its multiple effects on the ecosystem and on the economy, both globally and here in the United States. There are some important lessons that I think we have learned through the debate that has occurred. I've come up with 10 principles for how I think we might make real bipartisan progress on the issue in the next Congress. Perhaps you can add to that list. I think that may have been passed out to people this morning. I won't go over each of these in detail, but let me just touch on one important theme. I believe that we do need a system for regulating greenhouse gases that is a great deal more streamlined than what we've been considering to date. As the various proposals have been developed including the one that I developed along with Senator Spector, there's been a natural tendency to try to accomplish several different priorities in a single climate bill. Many of these priorities are worthwhile, but they are also directly connected. They are also not directly connected to the establishment of an actual regulatory system of trading emission allowances. The resulting excessive complexity that I think has been reflected in bills may have hurt the cause of climate legislation more than it has helped. Fortunately, we don't have to try to do everything that is worth doing on the subject of global climate change in one gigantic bill. In fact, it would be far better if we got started on some of the necessary preliminaries well before we initiated a cap-and-trade system. For example, the ultimate cost of any cap-and-trade system will be greatly influenced by the quality of the technologies that are ready to be implemented to reduce and avoid greenhouse gas emissions. If we wait until we start auctioning allowances under a cap-and-trade program to make the funds available for these technology developments, we simply won't have the technologies in time to support meaningful early reductions. Since almost all of the human-caused carbon dioxide emissions are related to energy production and transportation and use, an energy bill is an excellent opportunity to address these technological prerequisites in advance of a cap-and-trade bill. A well-designed and executed energy bill will reduce both the complexity and the cost of any eventual cap-and-trade legislation. There are several Senate committees that have opportunities in their specific jurisdictions to clear the way for an effective overall approach to global warming, and I look forward to working with colleagues there on the Senate Energy and Natural Resources Committee to help create this sort of forward momentum. So I've gone through a partial list of some of the key challenges that we will face in the new Congress related to energy and to global warming. I'm sure many of you can add to that list. My immediate plans for the next several weeks as chairman of the committee are to reach out and consider the ideas of colleagues on both sides of the aisle, both on the committee and off the committee, as we prepare for the next Congress. So then when the new Congress does convene, I hope we can put forward a starting point for energy legislation that will be both bold and broadly supported. I do think our committee has a long history of bipartisanship that stretches back to the time Scoop Jackson was chair in the 1970s, includes important energy laws by past chairmen such as Bennett Johnston in the 1992 law and Pete Domenici in 2005. Energy is not, in my view, an inherently partisan issue. If we care about our nation's future, then we need to look for that bipartisan, substantive, forward-looking approach to energy that has allowed us to make success in the past, to make progress in the past. I look forward to working with the new Obama administration and my colleagues in the Congress to help ensure that this is a very productive Congress on these issues. Thank you for inviting me. If any of you have any questions, I'm glad to respond to questions. How do we do?
Well, thank you for an excellent overview of an ambitious, for sure, agenda for the coming couple of years. We will take some questions and from the floor. First, there will be a microphone, so if you have a question, please wait for a microphone to get to you. And then a couple other simple rules we always like to announce here. Many of you have been here before, have heard these, but first, if you can identify yourself and your affiliation, and if you've got a question, if it is a statement, please end it with a question so we can make sure that they are questions rather than just a statement. So I suspect comments would be welcome. But I was going to take the prerogative of perhaps posing the first one, since I've never actually had a chance to ask a senator a question. I've been in the other place and been asked, but never had that question. You'd mentioned the work that needs to get done to get legislation passed, and I think it gets to one of the questions we keep hearing is that The issues of energy and climate change are very complex, and in the Congress, for sure, multiple jurisdictions come into play. And some think that just the fact that you have all those jurisdictions will make it very, very difficult to get something through. Have you had any thoughts about how, one, do you think that would be a problem? And secondly, how that might be addressed to work through in a way that bridges over all the different jurisdictional boundaries?
Well, I think there's no question that jurisdictions of committees make the task more complicated. But we worked through that in the 2005 bill. We worked through that in the 2007 bill, and essentially took proposals and ideas from various committees and put them together with what we came up with in our energy committee and brought it to the Senate floor. And the leadership was able to devote the floor time to getting it enacted in each case. I think a similar process needs to occur with an energy bill in this new Congress. I think probably a somewhat different approach needs to be taken on climate change, and I don't think we know yet exactly what that approach is, but climate change does involve a lot of committees as well, and I think that needs to be acknowledged.
Thank you very much, Senator. My name is Sidney Weintraub. I'm here at CSIS. I wanted to get your view on a flexible tax on oil imports, so that if we try experimental things that seem to be working, the investment will be made in those things without fear of the oil price going down and wipe out the experiment that may be taking place in order to find ways, better ways to get energy for transportation purposes.
Well, I think the politics of any kind of tax are problematic. I know there have been some articles recently about how we should put a variable tax on the price of gasoline at the pump, so that as the price of oil drops and the price of gasoline drops, a tax comes into effect, and consumers do not enjoy the benefit of those reduced oil prices. That'd be very tough to pass, and I don't think something like that has much prospect of being enacted. That would be my honest opinion.
Senator Joe Kamelick with ISIS News. Point 7 of your 10 principles on climate change legislation says that, suggests that you cannot impose a cap and trade system unless and until carbon capture and sequestration is proven technically and commercially viable. Do you think that you'd have to postpone a cap and trade system until we get carbon capture and sequestration on a commercial basis?
No, I don't think we can postpone enactment of a cap-and-trade system until we answer those questions. But I do think that it's going to be a very important factor in determining what our future course is for meeting our energy needs. If we do need to determine whether or not carbon capture, transportation, and storage is going to be a viable solution to the greenhouse gas emission problems of using coal for power generation. And I don't think we have the answer to that as yet.
Senator Tom Doggett with Reuters. Could you give us an idea of your thinking on a rescue package for the automakers? How would it be written? How would it have to be written for you to support such a measure, or maybe oppose it? And at this point, can you tell us if you're leaning towards supporting a package?
Well, I haven't been involved in some of the intimate discussions that I think are probably taking place on that subject. My own view is we need to find a way to maintain a domestic auto industry. Clearly we need to do it in a way, if we're going to use taxpayer dollars, we need to do it in a way that enhances the likelihood that whatever's invested will be repaid at some future time. So I can't tell you the detail of how that package needs to be structured. I think there'll be an effort this week, as I understand it, in the Senate to pass some type of legislation for some type of assistance. Whether that will prevail or not, I'm not clear.
Hi, George Lobson's with the Energy Daily. You mentioned in your talk that you thought a more streamlined approach to climate change regulation was needed, and I wondered if you could give us maybe just what you see as some of the more interesting ideas that you're hearing to do that. And I'm wondering if you're talking about some sort of modified cap and trade or really talking about something altogether different.
No, I'm not talking about something altogether different. I am talking about a cap and trade system, but one that would focus more directly on the reduction of emissions and would not take on the task of trying to do a bunch of other things as well. That was the main point I was trying to make. I do think that legislation we have considered in the past has tried to reduce emissions and then has tried to also do a great deal else. As I say, the legislation that I proposed with Senator Spector and various other senators something over a year ago had some of that same problem.
Thank you, Senator. I'm Gary Marr with the Alberta, Washington office at the Canadian Embassy. I'm wondering how you feel oil sands fits into your view that we continue to need fossil fuels to get us in conventional sources, and where the Alberta oil sands fits into that.
Well, I think clearly I think there's great potential from Alberta oil sands. I think the issue there becomes, again, greenhouse gas emissions. And that's an issue. I understand there are initiatives underway to try to reduce greenhouse gas emissions resulting from development of those oil sands. I'm not clear as to exactly how promising those initiatives are, but that's going to be a key factor, which I'm sure will be an issue both in this country and in Canada.
Good morning, Senator. Tyler Suders with Clean Skies TV News. How closely have you read the President-elect's New Energy for America plan, and how much of an influence do you anticipate that having on the drafting process for your pending legislation?
Well, I have read it during the course of the campaign, but I would say in answer to your second question there, I think we're clearly going to try to be in sync in the Energy Committee. We're going to try to start out in sync with the new administration and the new president as to what needs to be enacted. I think that the debate or the dialogue between the Congress and the new administration on each of the proposals the president talks about in his campaign is just now beginning.
Thank you very much, Senator. My name is Martin Apple. I'm the president of the Council of Scientific Society Presidents. My primary interest is in the question of the Energy Department, the ability to create new science and technology, and the timeline that we have. We're essentially on a trapeze. We know we have to let go of one bar, and we can't reach out and grab the other one unless it's there. So we have to do some creating. And the Department of Energy just running the way it is and accreting something else may not be the way. It may need some major reorganizations, may need some rethinking. Energy ARPA may be a model, but it maybe should be instituted in a way in which you have a horse race of 100 horses running at the same time instead of betting on any one or two and seeing which ones emerge as the fastest and best. But I think we need a major policy shift in this, and I don't see how you're addressing it in your legislation.
Well, we have. I don't think you've seen our legislation. I haven't, at least. If you have a way you think it should be addressed, I would invite you to get it to us. I mean, we're open to ideas about how to get this problem fixed. So if you think there's a better way to do it than ARPA-E proposed, we're anxious to hear.
You got a lot of hands. Anybody here? We'll take right here in the fifth row.
Yes, Senator, my name's David Sander with Chevron, and my question is, what is your thinking on the Dingell Boucher draft legislative language effort?
Frankly, I haven't studied it in any great detail as yet, and I don't have an opinion on it.
Senator Bingaman, thanks for being here today. We really appreciate it. My name is Sarah Ladislaw. I'm here at the Energy Program at CSIS. I was just wondering if you could talk a little bit about how the global financial crisis and the concerns over the economy might change your view on how we do energy policy going forward.
Well, I think clearly the global financial crisis has changed a lot of things in the equation. I mean, we've seen the dramatic drop in the price of commodities. That of course raises questions about how effective our current policies are going to prove to be with regard to moving people from traditional uses of energy or traditional sources of energy to new sources. I don't think that I think there's more of a imperative on Congress to rethink the various policies that we have put in place in light of what's happened. I think that would be the main general impact of this global financial situation on things as I see it now.
My name's Karen St. John. I'm with BP. And there's been, I want to applaud you for all of your efforts in the past on trying to pursue cap and trade, which we are very supportive of. I was encouraged by legislative principle number 8 that deals with the Clean Air Act, because the last thing you want is dual regulatory systems. There is going to be an issue in terms of what happens in terms of the regulatory route before climate legislation is enacted. And I'd be interested in knowing whether you plan to have any hearings on this issue or any discussions with the Obama administration on this topic.
Well, I think we clearly are going to have discussions with the Obama administration as to whether they intend to proceed to comply with the Supreme Court mandate and to go forward in establishing rules under the Clean Air Act, or if they instead are concentrating on going ahead with proposing some kind of cap and trade system, or what their view is, or whether they even agree with number 8 on this list. I'm sure there are many who don't. But it does seem to me that at least what we should aim for, if we can, is to have an effective system of regulating greenhouse gas emissions that is not duplicative of other systems.
Hi, Jeff Young with a public radio show called Living on Earth. Following up on that last question, an advisor to the Obama campaign, now President-elect, indicated that it would be useful to allow EPA to regulate greenhouse gases under the Clean Air Act as a sort of spur to Congress. Do you agree that's a useful way to give Congress incentive to act? And do you agree with the President-elect's advisor that authorizing EPA to continue with regulating greenhouse gases is a good idea? Should they complete the endangerment finding?
Well, I guess I don't buy the basic premise that the administration and Congress are working at cross purposes here. I don't think it's a circumstance where the president and the new administration are in favor of enacting a cap and trade system and Congress is not. I think Congress is in favor of going forward on that as well. So I believe that the best course would be to get the administration and the Congress to agree on a timetable for enactment of for consideration and enactment of a cap and trade system, and also a timetable for development of any rules that EPA intends to proceed with. I think the fact that EPA is under a mandate from the Supreme Court does put pressure both on the administration and on the Congress. That much I certainly agree with.
Okay, one over here. I can't see you guys on the side, so let me take a question from Andy.
Andy Patterson with Econergy. I wanted to ask you about CCS. The challenge is always how to pay for it. I think what's interesting is that at least the Boucher CCS bill proposes a mill charge like we have for nuclear to pay for CCS, and we're going to have to take care of the liability in the long term on CCS. Are these principles that the Senate could get behind that are advanced in the Boucher CCS bill?
Well, I can't speak for the Senate, obviously. My own concern, one concern I've had with that is I think we need to guard against a circumstance where the Congress is using essentially its taxing authority and then turning the money over to someone else to spend. That's always been something that Congress has been loath to do. I think there's that problem with the voucher bill. As I understand the bill, he raises the funds through the charge on electric bills and then turns it over to EPRI to decide how the funds are spent. I don't know that that's the ideal solution to the allocation of the money. Yeah, Congress isn't very good at supervising boards. Congress is better at appropriating money than it is supervising boards.
Thank you for being here today. Vijay Nilekani from NEI. I have a question. Nuclear already generates 20% of the electrical grid in the U.S., the generation, and has already saved millions of tons of carbon avoidance. And the Japanese and the French are the closest to their targets because of very high nuclear generation. What are your views on nuclear power generation? Thank you.
Well, my views are that nuclear power makes a very substantial contribution to meeting our energy needs. We put various provisions in the 2005 energy bill to promote the construction of additional nuclear power plants. Some of that is beginning to happen. I don't know what the effect of this global financial crisis is going to be on that. One of the things that I perhaps should have been more specific about is in talking about a review of the loan guarantee program, I think we need to think through whether or not it is performing the function that we had in mind with regard to possible construction of new nuclear plants as well.
Thank you, Senator Bingaman. My name is David Gerard, and I'm with the Rockefeller Foundation. And my question is, to what extent do you see the energy legislation that you proposed being able to drive the National Surface Transportation Bill in a manner that makes our transportation sector more competitive, builds better infrastructure, weans it slowly off petroleum and so forth? So how do you see the energy legislation feeding into, say, a National Surface Transportation Bill?
Well, I haven't thought through what the impacts of an energy bill might be on that. I think some of this will depend upon whether or not and to what extent we try to deal with energy efficiency in the transportation sector. That really does come under the jurisdiction of the Commerce Committee to a significant degree. And just as in the 2007 Act, where we brought provisions from the Commerce Committee and added them to what we had produced in the Energy Committee, we may well wind up doing that kind of thing in a new energy bill, but I think it's too soon to know whether that would occur.
Okay, we have time just for a couple more questions. Shirley?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Shirley Neff. I'm currently the president of the Association of Oil Pipelines, but also a fellow here at CSIS and former staffer of the senators on the Energy Committee. One of the fundamental problems in the electric sector and really figuring out how to solve these issues is the jurisdictional conflict between the federal government and the minimal authorities it really has to drive change in the electric sector and all the various states. And I know, you know, there have been various ways of trying to figure out how to get greater policy uniformity or consensus between the federal government and the various states. Do you see a serious effort at that in the new Congress and with the new administration?
Well, I certainly hope so. I agree with you that a major obstacle to moving ahead with electricity grid and a lot of these other issues has been the fact that much of the jurisdiction in these areas resides at the state level, and the federal government has never assumed that authority. We need to look at that because we give lots of speeches around the Congress about the importance of a national grid, and it's just hard to see how you ever get to a national grid if you don't have more ability at the federal level to bring about uniformity in policy.
Thank you very much, Senator Bingham. My name is Shuji Okuzaki. I'm with Tohoku Electric Power from Japan. In my understanding, Bingham and Spector bill had one of the most it was one of the most welcomed one by the energy industry because it had a safety valve. Safety valve mechanism on the cap and trade system. Are you going to try again to introduce a similar one on the next next Congress?
Frankly, I haven't decided whether it makes sense to go ahead and introduce an updated version of legislation or not. I do still believe that having some type of safety valve is an appropriate provision to include in a cap and trade bill. I think probably having a cap and a floor both make some sense as far as the price of allowances going forward. I think just the volatility that we've seen in commodity prices and markets generally, I think, further reinforces the need to build some stability into a system if we're going to establish a new market for tradable allowances.
So, one last question. I think we'll take it right here from the front. Coming on the side.
Thank you. I'm Dick Van Adder from the Science and Technology Policy Institute. And I was looking at the interrelationship between the energy innovation ideas and the deployment ideas that you've been talking about. And in between there is the demonstration concepts and large-scale funding and financing that's needed for that. You mentioned some alternatives to the loan guarantee program. We've already had a little discussion in terms of the voucher approach with funding going to another entity, that entity then expending the resources. How do we get the public interest and the public concerns through these external entities that can set the priorities and set the directions when we have dominant vested interest in energy companies and others who are so strong at the table?
Well, I think as a general matter, our former government tries to get the public perspective into these decisions through elected officials. And I think it's possible that we can take the kernel of the idea in the voucher bill and find a way to get elected officials more involved in actually deciding how the funds would be spent, and that may be part of the solution.
Well, Senator Bingham, thank you very much for taking
sure.
this time to come
thank
here.
Thank you.
We wish you all the best of luck in pushing through this package. Again, join me in thanking the Senator.